This is Self-Work, and I'm Dr. Margaret Rutherford. At Self-Work, we discuss psychological and emotional issues and what you can do about them, whether that's learning self-acceptance, taking action, or seeking therapy or treatment. 8 years ago, I extended the walls of my practice to reach those of you who might already be knowledgeable about mental health treatment, but also to those of you who might say you'd never darken the door of a therapist. And yet, you are here. I'll answer your questions while I invite you to take a few minutes for your own self-work.
My point is that when you engage your parasympathetic nervous system, several things happen. You have the release of different neurotransmitters. One most commonly known is oxytocin, the bonding, the love, the connection hormone. Mm-hmm. And that stimulates your pleasure and reward centers. You want to be of help to people because you enjoy it.
Welcome to this week's edition of Self-Work. Often when I see the word transformation in someone's publicity to maybe try to get on self-work or something, I dismiss it entirely. But this author and this book, James R. Doty, Mind Magic, is very different. It was just released on May the 7th. He is a Stanford neurosurgeon, already a New York Times bestselling author, and a Dalai Lama collaborator. And he is saying that manifestation is actually rooted in science. Now, not the same kind that somebody's going to teach you a course for like 3 weeks and then all of a sudden all your dreams are going to come true. It's much more difficult than that, but there is a step-by-step way of doing it. It takes time. It takes effort. But Dr. Doty has lived that experience. As he said, he went from rags to riches, back to rags. He grew up in poverty, and he learned how to overhaul his thinking to focus on being more spiritually and morally centered. And you could actually use the structures of your mind for this to occur. You build new neural pathways, basically, so you can consciously create the life you want. I'm delighted to have Dr. Doty on Self-Work this week. Again, his book is Mind Magic. And I think you'll enjoy him. Before we begin, let's hear from one of our wonderful sponsors who make self-work possible, AG1. It's important to me that the supplements I take are of the highest quality. And that's why, for years, I've been drinking AG1. Unlike many supplement brands, AG1 conducts relentless testing to set the standard for purity and potency. Quality for AG1 isn't just a buzzword, it's a commitment. And at each step of the process, AG1 goes above and beyond industry standards. I know I can trust what's in every scoop of AG1 because they obsess over product quality, the standards of their manufacturing, and sustainable practices. Taking care of your health shouldn't be complicated, and AG1 simplifies this by replacing all those multiple health supplements, like your multivitamins, digestive aids, immune support, and more in just one simple scoop. AG1's ingredients are heavily researched for their quality, and I love that every scoop also includes prebiotics, probiotics, and digestive enzymes for gut support. I've partnered with AG1 for so long because they make such a high-quality product that I drink every day. So if you want to replace your multivitamin and more, start with AG1. Try it and get a free one-year supply of vitamin D3 plus K2 and 5 free AG1 travel packs with your first subscription at drinkag1.com/selfwork. Again, that's drinkag1.com/selfwork. Check it out. You'll be glad you did. And now, my interview with Jim Doty.
Life is not perfect in my limited experience.
Well, you know what? And that was one of my first comments, Jim, because you start out the book talking about your failure, your loss of everything, both materialistic and very non-materialistic. And then, so you start out in this very humble place, which in my book, as being a clinical psychologist for 30 years, you don't automatically get my trust because of that, but you go a long way in me saying,
this is not someone pontificating about, you know, all they've learned and all who they are and what they, this is someone with a message that's bigger than them. And I so appreciated that.
Well, that's very, very kind of you.
So your first two chapters start out sort of an introduction. What am I already manifesting? Network and vibrations, which I've got so much to ask you about there. And then you go through these six steps, which are, you turn them into, not only do you talk about their importance and what they all mean and how they all integrate and what their part is, but you also talk about how important the practice of this, what you call manifesting, is so important. And I want to say one thing before, let me read your definition of manifestation. The power of our own minds to produce changes in our lives that may at first seem impossible. Quote. Can you say what you, I mean, give us a synopsis of that, Dr. Doty.
Well, I think what happens to many people, especially people who come from challenging backgrounds, is that either they carry baggage from their childhoods, which they have integrated into their perception of self, which results in limiting their beliefs or their understanding of what is possible for them.
Right.
And there's also a group of people who believe that there is something outside of themselves that has some power to change their lives, and that if only that person hears them, and some people call it the law of attraction. If I put positive vibes out and say what I want, there's some external entity that's going to grant that wish. And I think that's really a problem, because people don't understand the power of their own minds to change their reality.
Mm-hmm.
And as you well know, once you tell yourself, and so many people have negative self-talk, once you tell yourself, I'm not worthy, it's not possible, I don't deserve love, that becomes reality.
So what would you say to the critics who might know of you and of me? What would you say to them to say, well, you're two older white people? This is easy for you to say.
Sure. I certainly appreciate a statement like that. It's always interesting. If you look at my resume superficially, you could sit there and say, well, he's a white elite guy from an affluent background. He has no clue about suffering. Obviously, he's in this pampered academic environment, and he has no clue.
Right.
Now, what I would counter that with is, and this is a problem for many people, they make assumptions about people,
mm-hmm.
and many people are wrong. I grew up in poverty in a mixed neighborhood, to say the least. Right. My father was an alcoholic. My mother had a stroke when I was a child, was partially paralyzed, had a seizure disorder. We were on public assistance essentially my entire childhood. And was evicted from multiple residences.
You tell that story beautifully in the book.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I mean,
beautiful
I
now,
have,
not so beautiful then.
Well, it all depends on how you frame it. So I have great understanding of suffering, that type of suffering. And it's interesting, if you look at children who come from these backgrounds. And of course, there is a diagnostic system, if you want to call it that, called adverse childhood experiences, where if you add up, as an example, whether there was poverty, whether there was alcohol, et cetera, the likelihood of a child, quote unquote, successfully coming out of that or becoming a quote unquote success by societal standards becomes more and more limited.
Mm-hmm.
So I have a clear understanding of suffering. And also, people who survive these situations, they go in one of two directions. One direction is they unfortunately become either drug or alcohol users or have mental health issues.
Mm-hmm.
Then the other is they do well, but that path then diverges. There's a subset of people who do, quote unquote, well, and their perception is that nobody helped me. I did this on my own, and I have no interest, and they don't deserve my help, people suffering, because I did it on my own.
Yeah.
Now, of course, that's a false narrative, and it's a sad false narrative, because none of us survive or do well in this world without the help of other people. The other side is you understand what suffering is on a very deep level. You appreciate it, and you don't want others to suffer.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And that gives you a view, a different view of the world. Because if you look at it from the selfish perspective, you don't understand that a lot of people in these situations that are simply by accident or circumstance or, frankly, societal barriers that have been created, and it's not their fault. And in that context, then you look at it through the narrative of how can I use my tools or gifts to be of service to others that give them the opportunity to succeed in life.
You were that child. Your dad was gone or practically gone. Your mother was ill. And then you met Ruth. Can you talk about Ruth a little bit?
Sure. So in my circumstance, which was quite chaotic and like being in a war zone, and the reason I say that is nothing was predictable. It would seem like everything was perfect. My father would show up every day, and then he would just disappear for days to weeks.
Yeah.
And we had no idea. We were poor. Or my mother would go into a deep depression and attempt to commit suicide. And so you never knew what was going to happen.
Mm-hmm.
But the other thing, it was so painful to live in that when there were arguments or challenges, oftentimes I would get on my bicycle and ride as far and as fast as I could away from that situation.
Mm-hmm.
And on one of those trips, I ended up at a strip mall where there was a magic shop. And the magic shop was interest because I had an interest in magic at that time. So I walked in, and I'm sure you have met, and members of the audience have met, people who have a radiant presence.
Yes.
They have a smile. They don't look down at you. They look at you eye to eye.
They see you. They really see you from the very moment you meet them.
Exactly. And they listen. And, you know, when you're in that situation, it gives you this sense of psychological safety.
Mm-hmm.
And this is what this woman offered me, which allowed me to trust her, to speak freely with her. And she was quite insightful. It turned out she was the owner's mother, and she actually knew nothing about anything in the magic shop. But we had a wonderful conversation. And after about 20 minutes, she said to me, she said, you know, I really like you. I'm here for 6 weeks this summer. If you show up every day, I'll teach you something that I think could really help you. And I was filled with hopelessness and a sense of despair.
And here was this woman reaching out to you saying, let's see where this goes.
Absolutely. And I did show up. And it wasn't because I was particularly self-aware. It was because I had absolutely nothing else to do. And she was giving me chocolate chip cookies.
Yeah.
So I did show up. But what she taught me did change the trajectory of my life, because it allowed me to understand how I had created my limited beliefs, if you will,
mm-hmm.
based on a narrative that I would tell myself. And of course, there's this thing called negativity bias. And through a mindfulness practice that was combined with self-compassion and addressing the issue of the negative dialogue that was going on in my head with positive self-affirmation, and then understanding that everyone is suffering, it changed everything. And once I won't say mastered the techniques, but once I learned those techniques, then she taught me a a visualization technique. And that really gave me some incredible insights of the power of the mind. And as we know, you can use a term that's commonly used, which is what fires together wires together.
I've never heard that.
Oh, well, it's basically how you create neural pathways and strengthen them.
But fires together wires together. That's very interesting.
Yeah, because what happens is through intention mm-hmm. and repetition, mm-hmm. You create neural pathways that become very strong. And so through a visualization technique is one way to do that, where you repeatedly visualize you being in a particular position. But what is a common manifestation technique, which is promoted sort of by the woo-woo pseudoscience side of the house.
See what I was about to say.
Does have some validity. And that is using your sensory organs to strengthen these pathways. And one is to first, you have to decide what it is you wish to manifest. Then secondly, you write it down. You read it silently. You read it aloud. You see yourself in that position. And then over time, that vision of yourself being in that position becomes more and more clear. But what happens is, if you do it correctly, and the book outlines, if you will, ways to maximally have that occur, then you can, in fact, change the trajectory of your own life. And I was fortunate in that ultimately happened to me, although I will preface this by telling you that as a 12-year-old doing those exercises, I had a false belief of success.
Mm-hmm.
And what I mean
by
that
was your intention was money, success, a big car. Yeah,
exactly. And unfortunately, that is what Western capitalist consumer consumption narrative is. Success mm-hmm. is having things. Success is having the big house.
Yeah, because, a TikTok influencer.
yeah, because you want people to look at you and say, he's a success. And what you're trying to do is to get external affirmation to fill the emptiness and shame and insecurity that you have. Mm-hmm. And of course, it never does. And so for me, I went on that path where I did, in fact, manifest everything on that list. But it wasn't out of being of service. It was so others would look at me and tell me I was successful. And right. that was the mistake, because we have a society that has been indoctrinated into that belief. Mm-hmm. If you're poor and you look at the media, what does it say success is? It'll show somebody and an influencer or somebody on TikTok. They're driving a Rolls Royce. They're pulling up to the mansion. They're surrounded by people. They're at a party. And that is the most hollow, empty form yeah. of quote unquote success. Yeah. And I think this is the difference, and you could call it, and we can go into a little bit more detail, the difference between fear and love. Those people are working from a fear place,
mm-hmm.
and they're also focused on hedonic happiness.
You mentioned that distinction in the book, yeah. hedonic, and I'm going to crucify this word.
Eudaimonic.
There you go. I'm so glad you said it and not.
hedonic happiness is all about self. It's how do I seek the greatest amount of pleasure? Yeah, exactly. Greatest amount of pleasure, avoid pain. And the problem with that is it's empty and it's transitory and it's shallow. And as a result, it's never long lasting, because you have to get more and more. In some ways, it's addictive.
It is.
And of course, it doesn't help anybody. It neither helps you, because you still feel empty, and you're not giving anybody something that can help them, other than a false belief that if they follow your path, they're going to have this quote unquote abundance. Now, we simply need to look at it and several sad aspects of our society. If you ask high school students what they want to be, many of them, a majority, will say they want to be an influencer. Mm-hmm. They want to be a celebrity. They want to be rich. And it's horribly sad. because in no way does that fulfill you as a human being. Mm-hmm. And in fact, it promotes self-absorption. And, you know, unfortunately, what has also contributed to this is we had a narrative that was promoted by people in the education system that everyone is a winner. You run a race, there are 10 contestants, everybody gets an award. And as a result, you create a sense of entitlement. And the reality is the world is highly competitive.
Yeah.
And there are winners and there are losers. Whether I like it, you like it, that is reality.
I have almost a 30-year-old as a son, and he plays soccer. And so this was, what, 2 or 3 years ago? And he'd get this old trophy. We get in the car, and he goes, "Mom, I know I didn't win. Why did they say?" I said, "Well, I didn't say the words. I said it's the way people think you should. But you're right. You lost."
Yeah, so, and people have to have that is the reality check. You didn't perform.
When my mom talked about menopause, she called it the change, and it was all very hush hush, as if there was something wrong about something so natural. Thank goodness with mental health awareness and actual research, we're beginning to understand the huge role hormones play in women's bodies. Being postmenopausal has its challenges, but if you're going through either perimenopause or menopause, then I suggest you try Hormone Harmony. Why? Happy Mammoth, the company that created Hormone Harmony, is dedicated to making women's lives easier. Hormone Harmony contains science-backed herbal extracts called adaptogens. Now, here's the beauty about them. They help the body adapt to stressors, like chaotic hormonal changes that happen naturally throughout a woman's life. For a limited time, you can get 15% off on your entire first order at happymammoth.com. Just use the code SELFWORK at checkout. That's happymammoth.com and use the code SELFWORK for 15% off today.
Now, so it's also created an entitlement narrative that, well, I don't have to do anything. I show up and I should get all of this stuff. Yeah. And so people who chase that, actually, many, many of them are unhappy. And I'll tell you the difference and how I perceive it on a personal level. So you have eudaimonic happiness, which your goal is for purpose and meaning in your life. Mm-hmm. And when you act in that way, first of all, you're not focused on yourself. You're focused on how can I be of service to others?
Right.
And the Dalai Lama has a great quote that says, if you wish to make others happy, be compassionate. If you wish to be happy, be compassionate. And actually, that's a very, very profound statement, because what a lot of people don't appreciate is that when you are of service to others, you are actually benefiting yourself in a huge way. Because when you're working out of the fear state, you are stimulating chronically your sympathetic nervous system. The other path is if you look towards being of service to others, how do you benefit? Well, your physiology positively benefits because you shift into engagement of your parasympathetic nervous system.
I thought that there was a fact in the book. By the way, the sympathetic nervous system and the parasympathetic nervous system are two parts of the autonomic nervous system for anyone listening. And when you are aroused, when you're agitated, when you feel stressed, when you feel fear, you're in your sympathetic nervous system. And when you are more relaxed, you call it rest and digest mode, then you're in your parasympathetic nervous system.
My point is that when you engage your parasympathetic nervous system, several things happen. You have the release of different neurotransmitters. One most commonly known is oxytocin, the bonding, the love, the connection hormone, mm-hmm. and that stimulates your pleasure and reward centers. You want to be of help to people because you enjoy it. You feel pleasure doing that. The other aspects is it positively affects your physiology, the opposite of how engagement of your sympathetic nervous system does.
That's the fact I was trying to get to. And I found this biologically fascinating, is that when we're in the sympathetic nervous system, when we're stressed, our body works to automatically to produce, to help us fight bacterial infections, because we're about to get wounded. We're about to get, you know, we're in a war. We need our bacterial immune system to try to help us. But when you're in rest and digest, when you're in parasympathetic and you feel like, okay, I want connection, I'm going to work for connection, I'm going to welcome connection, then your body prepares itself for a viral infection, which of course tends to happen more when people are connected. I just thought that was fascinating.
And in fact, if you look at us from an evolutionary perspective, unlike other species, our offspring don't run off into the jungle or the forest. We have to care for them.
Mm-hmm. You need that connectivity. Mm-hmm.
Exactly. And so how does our evolution make that happen? Because our offspring need to be cared for well over a decade. So that requires us to be motivated to care and put in the time and resources. And that is through being rewarded. And so we have a genetic imperative to care. And when we care, every aspect of our evolution promotes our survival, and that's through connection. Mm-hmm. And the interesting thing about that is that if you look at the work of Bob Buettner and the Blue Zones, or you look at the work of the Harvard Adult Development Study, which many people...
Bob Waldinger call, did that.
But anyway, what do we know? Well, yes, diet is great. A plant-based diet's great. Exercise is great, et cetera, et cetera. By far and away, the most important aspect of every one of these studies is the reality that if you have depth of relationship, strong connections to others, it keeps you in this parasympathetic nervous system mode, which is where we need to be. That's how we were designed. The sympathetic nervous system in, I won't say too ancient, but was designed for acute situations or immediate situations when your survival is at risk, such as, you're sitting in the savannah in Africa and you see the grass move and you know that may symbolize a tiger or a lion or whatever, and you have to act immediately.
Let's get back to some of the nuts and bolts of the book. And we are talking about the book without really talking about the book, but the term self-agency, you make a point, as does your colleague David Spiegel, that there are gaps between, what is it, Frankl said this, I think. Viktor Frankl, yeah. Anyway, he says there are gaps between the stimulus and the response. And basically what that means is that you could have the urge to do something. You can want to, write a nasty text to somebody, or you can, you could have this stimulus, but you can change your response to it. You can widen that gap between what you've been doing habitually and was always gotten you into trouble, like having a drink with that guy's already had three.
And you've had three.
And so, you think, well, this is good. This is normal. I'm obviously attracted to him. And so you can change your what you're attracting by changing some of your own actions. And all of that to ask you to talk about self-agency, because you really talk a lot about that in your book.
Sure. I mean, if you look at what, if you want to call it sort of how manifestation has been presented in our society through the woo-woo and pseudoscience, and as you know, there are a number of scientific principles that have been validated, but then they get out in the, I'm not sure if mainstream is the right word, but they get baggage that gets attached to them and false narratives about them. And then they promote these in combination as if it's truth. And of course, oftentimes it's for selfish reasons, right? Somebody's, I'm going to teach you manifestation in 10 easy lessons. You just pay $150 and you will have the answers and you will be driving the same Rolls Royce that I'm driving, right? And there is a great deal of science behind it, but you have to do it correctly. Because as an example, the executive control network, which is a cognitive brain network, primarily in your frontal area, it works best when your parasympathetic nervous system is engaged, and it gives you more discerning thoughts about how to do things. And it's sort of the CEO driver of our desires. Well, if you're in fear mode or you've engaged your sympathetic nervous system, that shuts down.
Yes.
So it impairs you in some ways. And it gives you actually, or limits your ability to manifest, if you will, the right way. And again, I am not saying, because people said to me, so Jim, are you saying that people shouldn't try to live a life of success and accomplishment? Right. And that's completely false. Listen, I get paid as a neurosurgeon more than 99.9% of people. Listen, I'm in the top 1%. Mm-hmm. I'm not against that. And frankly, I live in a very nice house and I drive a Porsche. And I've had every type of car possible, and I've lived in a variety of extraordinary places. It's not that I'm against living well. The difference is, though, and this is actually what I meant to get to a little bit earlier, is the difference between hedonic and eudaimonic happiness.
Yeah, we got to go on track.
Yeah, that's okay. If I were to lose all of that tomorrow, it's perfectly okay. Do I want to lose it? No. But it doesn't define who I am. It doesn't make me who I am. I don't need people to look at me and go, oh, he's driving a Porsche, or I drove by his house and there's a long driveway there. He must be rich.
But let's make the point quickly that you did lose it all. I want to remind people of that. You're not only speaking theoretically, but you're speaking out of your own history.
Well, and it gets back to how I was misdirected, or I misdirected myself as a child. Because I did take Ruth's lessons. And yes, I was able to go to medical school. I became a neurosurgeon. I became a professor at Stanford. I was the CEO of a company that went public for $1.3 billion. I had everything, yet I was more miserable than I had ever been. And I couldn't understand it initially. And the problem was, I was doing all of these things so people would tell me how great I was.
Yeah.
And that would fill the void that I had inside of myself, which was based on my own insecurity and shame that I carried.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I was sitting there reflecting, where did I go wrong? And I went wrong because of what we're just talking about. I was focused on me. It was all about me. Every action I would take, it was, well, people are going to look at me. And even though I was always a kind, thoughtful doctor, it was still about, I'm a doctor, I'm a neurosurgeon.
Mm-hmm.
And I realized that is the lesson I missed from Ruth, what she was really trying to teach me.
Here is a quote from you. As a result, we have created a prison for ourselves that limits our self-agency. And then you say, self-compassion is the inner critic's kryptonite. And I think it sounds like to me, is that you began seeing, wait a minute, this purpose that I have, well, your purpose being self-aggrandizement, I guess, and finally lost its luster, and you were able to truly give what you could and get out of that prison to actually have, I can make a choice here that is not solely in my best interest financially. It's in my best interest as a person. and that is a huge change.
The important point here is that I tell people, I went from rags to riches. I mean, literally riches. Then I went to rags. And when I say rags, again, I don't want to misconstrue. I was always a neurosurgeon,
right,
making a lot of money. So I was not living in my car. But comparatively, it was from rags to riches to rags.
Mm-hmm.
But the greatest gift I got was actually when I gave everything away, even though I was $3 million in the hole. And what do I mean by that? Well, I started the center at Stanford, which studies the neuroscience of compassion, empathy. And empathy, the Dalai Lama actually became the founding benefactor. He and I became friends. I ended up being the chairman of the Dalai Lama Foundation. And then that led me to become friends with Desmond Tutu, Thich Nhat Hanh, many of the major spiritual and religious leaders in the world, to have, you know, not only having met them, that's spent time with them, if you will, counseled them, participated in events that they were doing. And that, imagine what that's like to be with and spend time with some of the most elevated spiritual and religious people in the world. It is an incredible gift, and it's so powerful. Now, I will tell you, I am in no way religious. In fact, I tell people I'm an atheist. But the point is, these people live above their dogma, and they look at the world through the lens of compassion, caring. How can I be of service? Because that has such a positive effect on them, as well as all the people they're helping. And again, you meet every one of these people, and they have a presence, a radiance about them. And this is why people follow them, because fundamentally, people want to be around people who are inspiring, who present a message of how we can all be. And it isn't one, unfortunately, that is base in nature, that brings out the most base instincts in people, because those people are living in fear and fundamentally are unhappy. How do you live a life of purpose and meaning to inspire others to be your best self? And that is through compassion. It's recognizing the needs of others. And when you look through that lens, it also changes what you want or what you think is important.
One point before we need to stop that I want to get back to, because I do think it is something people, myself included, don't sometimes either feel like is important. I mean, I know it's important, but then do I do it? It's, you know, you, and I'm quoting you again, if your desire is so unfamiliar to the brain that fulfilling it would require extra energy or increased energy, the brain will ignore it. And then I use this analogy that was intriguing to me about this bloodhound and then goes back sniffing around your life to see, okay, how could this happen? Well, is it over here? Is it over here? Is it over here? And I loved that, because I think that sometimes when we do dream, when we do do a transformative thing, when we do some kind of imagination and visualize, then it does like open a window into your mind, your heart, your unconscious or subconscious, whatever you want to call it, that when that comes your way, instead of it being something that feels like, oh, I couldn't do that, that all of a sudden you go, wait a minute, this is kind of what I thought about doing 5 years ago, but I never realized that it might come my way. But here it is. Why don't I walk through that door?
But again, your brain is also lazy, and it doesn't want to put forth effort. And that's why you have to understand it takes work. But and I'm sure you probably know B.J. Fogg. He wrote a book called Tiny Habits. But he's actually also a Stanford professor.
Well, there you
go. But the point is, he has a statement that to embed intention or to embed new habits, you have to start small. You don't say, I'm going to run a marathon and try running 26 miles day one.
Yeah.
And because it becomes self-defeating when you go out there and you start running, and after a mile or so, you're like exhausted and going, I'm never going to be able to do this.
Then terrible shin splints.
And then you go home and eat all that turkey dinner that's left over from the day before. So if you do start with tiny habits, if you do, as an example, instead of saying, I'm going to run a marathon, you're going to say, I'm going to wake up at 6 a.m. and I'm going to walk around the block. And it's something you can do. And you do that for a period of time and you realize, okay, I can do this. Then you increase it to 2. Then you increase it to 1 mile. Then suddenly you're running 1 mile. Then you're running 5 miles. And in some ways, this is what you have to do. You have to embed these habits into your subconscious. And what we talk about, or what I talk about in the book, is there are these different cognitive brain networks that need to be engaged for you to manifest.
This has been a fascinating conversation. And, sometimes people, a neurosurgeon wrote a book. Well, I'm not going to understand it or whatever. And, I was glad I was taking notes, because it was a book that once I, stopped to think about it, I kind of put it down in my own words, or I would put your words and then put a quote, which is a way I learn. And it's a very doable book. I want to point out, this is your book again, Mind Magic. Jim, it has been a pleasure, and I've learned a lot from you. Thank you very, very much for this interview.
No, thank you. I appreciate your time. It's a joy to connect.
I hope you'll pick up Jim's book. I really found him to be very, very real, not necessarily the neurosurgeon-like type that I'd expected, and I think what he has to offer could really help you. Again, it is called Mind Magic. Thank you, as always, for being here at Self-Work. I'm very grateful for your presence. Your questions, please email me at askdrmargaret@drmargaretrutherford.com, and I will get back with you. Leave me a SpeakPipe voice message, and you can find that on my website at drmargaretrutherford.com or right here in your show notes. I'm Dr. Margaret, and this has been Self-Work.